final investigator I met with was Dr. Martin Tallman, and to begin, he commented on a fascinating corner of oncology, hairy cell leukemia.
Hairy cell leukemia, despite its rarity, and it is amazingly rare, less than 1,000 new patients per year diagnosed in the United States, it's one of the most fascinating diseases. If for no other reason, it's fascinating because the name is derived from the appearance of the cells, and the cells have these hair-like projections that look sinister, actually. They look ominous. They really look like hair-like projections on the surface of the cell. But the disease natural history is anything but sinister and ominous. Actually, the disease has quite a favorable prognosis with regular standard therapy, which is a purine analog.
What's the cell of origin?
The cell of origin is actually a B cell. It was enigmatic for a number of years, but it's conclusively been shown now that hairy cell leukemia is derived from a B lymphocyte.
And can you talk a little bit about how you approach a patient initially, and what are some of the options that you go through?
In newly diagnosed patients, the manifestations are always really related to two observations, either a marked splenomegaly or pancytopenia. Splenomegaly, interestingly enough, is virtually the only physical finding for newly diagnosed patients. So if a patient has symptomatic splenomegaly or symptomatic cytopenias, anemia, thrombocytopenia, for example, neutropenia, we think they're a candidate for treatment. And the treatment of choice today, I think, is a single 7-day course of cladribine, a purine analog.
And what's the usual outcome with that?
85, maybe 90% achieve a complete remission. And the other 10%, 15% in general respond quite well and may normalize their blood counts, but they may not have complete eradication of the disease. But virtually everybody achieves a complete remission, remarkably, with a single 7-day course of therapy.
And what's the usual long-term outcome?
The majority of patients do very, very well. The relapse rate is between 25 and 30%. But by relapse, I mean the reappearance of some hairy cells in the bone marrow with perhaps even mild cytopenias. Not all the 20 or 30% of patients who relapse need to be retreated. So I would say the majority of patients, the overwhelming majority of patients, do very well and never need further therapy.
When patients do require treatment, when's the usual time sequence and how are they treated?
For relapse patients, the median time to relapse is about 2 to 3 years. For those patients that do relapse, and again, we don't necessarily treat all patients who relapse, only patients who fulfill our criteria. Again, for example, what we regard as life-threatening cytopenias, neutrophil count less than 1,000, hemoglobin less than 11 grams, platelet count less than 100,000, or symptomatic splenomegaly. So those are the criteria we use to treat, and interestingly enough, it's such an unusual lymphoproliferative disorder. Interestingly enough, the treatment of choice, I think, is a second course of cladribine. And with a second course of cladribine, patients do extremely well. In fact, some patients have a longer second remission than a first remission with the same treatment with another course of cladribine. And it may be that way because even though there's been a recurrence, the total tumor burden is less than at diagnosis. That's just speculative, though.
So you've just described an extremely unusual kind of scenario in oncology. What do you think the biology is behind this?
It's a remarkably indolent disease, And you can have treated patients and many years later, meaning 10, 15, 20 years later, you can actually find patients who have normal blood counts doing well, but have a small amount of hairy cell leukemia identified in their bone marrow. Again, attesting to the fact that this is a very, very indolent disorder.
So let's talk a little bit about AML. Maybe you can talk a little bit about some of the things that have come out over the past couple of years, some of the discussions that have gone on within the NCCN in terms of what are, you know, data sets that are, you know, causing you all to rethink your guidelines.
Well, I think you already made an important statement, and that is we're rethinking our guidelines. We're rethinking things. They're finally, after many years of, not for lack of trying, but for many years of somewhat stagnation in the field, there has been an explosion of activity. Part of the activity is the identification of new molecular genetic abnormalities that we think contribute to the pathogenesis of the disease. And the other large amount of activity has been in drug discovery and the identification of new agents to specifically target those molecular abnormalities. But I think we're also rethinking things because we've been stagnant with respect to outcome. Over the last 40 years, in younger patients, there's been some progress such that about 40% of patients who achieve remission, 45% of patients who achieve a remission appear to be cured of their disease if you're under the age of 60. But the median age of AML is now 72 years, we think. And therefore, among older adults, meaning 60 and older, we've made virtually no progress. Despite lots of clinical trials, lots of new drugs, we have made almost no progress. A patient who walks into a hospital who's over the age of 60 today has the same really poor prognosis they did 40 years ago. Very disappointing. So for that reason, we have also begun to rethink our guidelines for both older and younger patients.
So the head of the NCCN committee that you are vice chair of, Dr. O'Donnell, and your whole group put together this paper in the JNCCN, Risk Stratification and Emerging Treatment Strategies. Maybe you can go through the thinking that you all have had, as well as other investigators in the field, about, you know, how you're thinking it through clinically and also from a research perspective.
Sure. Well, we really do begin to divide patients broadly into younger patients and older patients, and that arbitrarily is 55 to 60. And we really believe that the disease is biologically different in older patients than younger patients. And that's a very important concept. Again, the median age is 72. So the treatment of older adults is very, very important. So we think of patients very differently. And there is some biologic basis for suggesting that patients with AML who are older are different and they behave differently. For example, they have more unfavorable chromosome changes, unfavorable cytogenetics, for example. Multi-drug resistance proteins are higher in older adults, for example. Older adults simply can't tolerate the kind of chemotherapy we can give younger patients. So there's clearly a difference in older adults and younger adults, and we're really thinking of them as different diseases in many ways. And let me make some additional comments about older adults, since, again, the average age is 72, so this is a very, very important large population of patients with AML. I would say the biggest change in our thinking about our approach to patients who are older with AML is to move away from conventional cytotoxic chemotherapy. Standard chemotherapy for 40 years has been induction chemotherapy with an anthracycline and cytarabine, and consolidation chemotherapy, consideration with or without an allogeneic hematopoietic stem cell transplant. But for older adults, we're learning over the years that they simply don't do very well with the so-called standard therapy. So I would say the biggest change in our thinking is trying to move away from standard cytotoxic chemotherapy toward, number one, less intensive strategies. For example, the hypomethylating agents, azacitidine and decitabine. And secondly, with more targeted therapy. Again, therapy drugs that target specific molecular genetic abnormalities. So I think those are two of the big changes. And I guess there's a third change. And the third change in our thinking in older adults is to try more often than we have in the past to harness the potential benefit of allogeneic hematopoietic stem cell transplantation. It wasn't that many years ago when I was a fellow, and we didn't transplant older adults very often. It was simply too toxic, the preparative regimen. Now, we're able to exploit the graft versus leukemia effect associated with transplantation with so-called reduced intensity conditioning. The preparatory chemotherapy is lower and more tolerable for older adults. So I think that's the third change. Number one, we're trying to eliminate and move away from conventional cytotoxic chemotherapy. Number two, we're trying to administer more targeted therapy. And number three, we are trying to harness the potential and move more older adults to allogeneic hematopoietic stem cell transplantation. That's for older adults.
In terms of transplant, can you talk a little bit more about the types of patients and the types of clinical situations where you think about it?
Well, I'll tell you what I really believe. I think about it in virtually every older adult. only the older adults that have favorable risk cytogenetics, favorable risk chromosomes, do I think twice. And those are patients that have either the, certainly the APL 1517, we don't consider transplantation at all. Number two, patients with the 821 translocation, unless they have a certain mutation called c-KIT, which confers a less favorable prognosis, they otherwise have a favorable enough prognosis, we think they may not benefit from transplant. And inversion 16 abnormalities, T1616 translocation, we also think they probably fare as well without a transplant and are not benefited. But other than that, I must say, virtually every patient now over the age of 60, we give some consideration. There are some data suggesting that they'll benefit. They don't benefit as much as we'd like them to benefit. But I think for many patients over the age of 60, in fact, it may be most, other than those with favorable chromosome abnormalities, I think the cure rate may be best if they're able to undergo transplantation.
And what do you say to them, and what do you expect in terms of toxicity?
Well, you're making a very, very important point. And I would say that one of the reasons we don't offer it to everybody, in fact, I'd consider it for favorable risk, not APL. APL we should talk about because that's one of the remarkable triumphs now in our field. But other than APL, we probably could offer allogeneic transplantation to every patient with AML if it weren't for the therapy-related mortality risk, morbidity and mortality. If those were lower, particularly mortality risk, we really would consider, I think, offering allogeneic transplantation to virtually every patient with AML, because I think that allogeneic transplantation has the best anti-leukemia effect. The problem is, of course, that has been and continues to be offset by the all-too-high transplant-related mortality risks. So we tell patients, if you're over the age of 60 and you have either intermediate or unfavorable risk chromosome abnormalities pattern, that we should give it some consideration if we can find a suitable donor. And if, as you're suggesting, we anticipate that transplant-related toxicity and mortality won't be prohibitively high. By that I mean the patient is otherwise reasonably fit, does not have major comorbidities that we think will contribute to transplant-related mortality. But we give it consideration now. I do, and I think most of my colleagues do, to virtually all patients over the age of 60.
And what specific mortality do you have in your mind to expect, and again, an otherwise fit 60-year-old?
Well, I think relapse certainly remains a problem, particularly for those patients who have more adverse or unfavorable chromosome abnormalities. But I think the immunologic reaction we call graft versus host disease, where the donated stem cells recognize the recipient's, the patient's tissues as foreign and begins to attack them. And that exists in an acute form and a chronic form. And that remains a major cause of non-relapse mortality associated with transplantation. And in fact, there hasn't been very much progress in that area. We need, other than steroids are the treatment of choice, and patients that have steroid refractory graft versus host disease, that is graft versus host disease of the skin, the liver, the gastrointestinal tract, that does not respond adequately to steroids, we really don't have adequate therapy beyond the calcineurin drugs, tacrolimus and sirolimus, and then steroids. It's a problem. So it's a major, major area for future research.
What kind of number do you give patients if they ask you, or what kind of number in your own mind do you have in terms of risk of mortality?
Well, reduced intensity conditioning, I think, provides less risk of mortality, but it's not inconsequential. A rough guide is about 10% at 1 year, about 20% at 2 years, and some studies suggest a 30% at 3 years. Now, again, there are some studies that suggest it's less than that, but I think that's a rough guide.
So you mentioned the issue of targeted therapy, and I'm curious where we are in terms of FLT3 and also crizartinib. I know you were involved with that. There was some data presented at ASH. Looked kind of interesting / impressive to me. Where are we with that target and other targets?
Well, I think, as you're suggesting, it's one of the most important targets. FLT3 occurs in about 20-25% of all patients, I think, with AML. Interestingly enough, the subtype of AML where it's found most often is APL, where it appears to have less importance because we do so well in APL despite the presence of FLT3. But of all subtypes, APL associated the most often, between 35 and 40% of patients with APL have a FLT3 internal tandem duplication. But in non-APL AML, it's between 20 and 25 or so percent. And it, in general, does confer an unfavorable prognosis. It confers, in general, a sufficiently unfavorable prognosis that those are also patients for whom we feel quite strongly that they proceed to an allogeneic stem cell transplantation, provided, again, a suitable donor can be identified and that they have minimal or no disease at the time of transplant and no comorbidities. As you're indicating, you're absolutely right. One of the most studied of the targets and one of the most active areas for drug discovery is FLT3 inhibitors. There were a group of inhibitors that were effective in the laboratory, but not particularly effective in vitro. But then the drug quizartinib, or AC220, came along. Actually, before quizartinib was sorafenib. Sorafenib, approved for certain solid tumors, appeared to be the first FLT3 inhibitor that did have single agent activity sufficient to induce complete remissions as a single agent. But in subsequent randomized studies, it appeared to be not as effective as we had initially thought. So quizartinib, or AC220, really does appear quite effective. And in fact, as a single agent in relapse and refractory patients, it has overall about a 50% or so what we call composite complete remission rate. The number of true complete remissions is quite small, but complete remission with inadequate platelet and other blood count recovery, that is eradication of all disease, but with incomplete peripheral blood recovery, that's included in the composite complete remission rate, which is quite respectable at 50% for a single agent in relapsed and refractory patients. So there's tremendous interest in moving that drug up front earlier in the natural history of the disease, particularly in combination with chemotherapy. So we're all very anxious for the results of studies that have been initiated of induction chemotherapy with and without quizartinib.
You mentioned sorafenib. Are there situations right now outside a trial setting that you think sorafenib might be a consideration?
I am not very enthusiastic about using sorafenib outside the context of a clinical trial. I don't know that it's necessarily wrong. And there are some studies that have combined sorafenib with cytarabine and other drugs that look promising, but they're phase 2 studies, and some larger randomized studies did not produce sufficiently promising results. So I myself have not been very enthusiastic about using sorafenib outside the context of a clinical trial.
I'm curious what your thoughts are about the drug vilisertib in terms of what it is, how it works. It's on an FDA fast-track approval in AML. What do we know about it?
Yes, it's an interesting drug. Vilisertib is a polo-like kinase inhibitor. It's involved particularly in the spindle apparatus, and it has its activity in that area in the formation and centromere segregation, spindle formation. And you're exactly right. It did get breakthrough based on a phase 2 study that randomized patients between low-dose Ara-C and low-dose Ara-C plus volasertib, showing a benefit in complete remission rate about 33% or so versus about 13%, and a trend toward an improvement actually in overall survival. And so it's, again, a promising drug. It has a unique mechanism of action. But I think despite the promising results of a randomized phase 2 study, I think we need a prospective randomized phase 3 study to really demonstrate and confirm its activity. But it's an interesting drug that's receiving a lot of attention.
This is the one that's being looked at combined with chemotherapy induction up front, correct?
It is in, well, at least the phase 2 study was in older adults, not suitable candidates
exactly.
for intensive chemotherapy.
So,
yes.
Right. So I think that's the same design in terms of phase 3.
Yes.
So how do you envision, well, I guess it's kind of hard to envision where it's going to fit in until I guess you see the phase 3.
I think that's right. I think it's very difficult to determine at this time.
So you mentioned APL, and you've written a lot about it. I always love talking about APL. It's just such a fascinating disease. Maybe you can comment a little bit on where we are today with this disease, and what are some areas that maybe we could look to try to improve in terms of management of these patients?
It is, as you're suggesting, a remarkable triumph as I mentioned also, in the area of acute leukemia in the last several decades. Now, about 85 to 90% of all patients appear to be cured of their disease. The major change has been the attempt to eliminate, at least minimize, and in fact, in many patients now, eliminate chemotherapy. And we're actually referring to, in many patients, all chemotherapy. Treatment of this disease now is focused on non-chemotherapy strategies, particularly with the combination of all-trans-retinoic acid, the vitamin A derivative that induces differentiation of the malignant cells in APL, plus the remarkably active agent arsenic trioxide. In fact, as remarkably effective as ETRA is, all-trans-retinoic acid, arsenic is even more active. In fact, it's the single most active agent in this disease. So there have been a number of studies now, including a very important study conducted in Europe and published in the New England Journal recently, randomizing newly diagnosed patients, newly diagnosed APL, to either a ATRA plus anthracycline-based chemotherapy, more conventional approach, versus ATRA plus arsenic trioxide, with no provision for chemotherapy except some hydroxyurea if the white count rises. And that phase 3 prospective study confirmed a benefit, an important benefit in overall survival, such that the overwhelming majority of patients, about 97, 98% of patients, appear to be cured of their disease. So the most remarkable change has been the movement away from chemotherapy toward a non-chemotherapy strategy. And I think in low-risk patients, I should add, those were younger patients in that European phase 3 study. They were under the age of 70, but they were low-risk patients, that is, patients who presented with a white count of 10,000 or less as the definition for low-risk. So I think it was a very important study, and I think it really established ATRA plus arsenic as a new standard of care for this disease. I'll say one other important point, I think, about APL. It's quite fascinating. The major limitation now to cure in most subtypes of AML is relapse and resistance. I mean, the treatment-related mortality other than transplant is quite modest, induction is modest, mortality associated with consolidation is very uncommon now, but relapse remains the major problem. In APL, in contrast, the major limitation to cure of all patients is early death. It's early death due primarily to bleeding, bleeding primarily in the CNS, somewhat in the gastrointestinal tract, and less in the lung. But it's remarkable to have a subtype of AML where resistant disease is not the major problem. Not only do the patients not often develop resistant disease, that is after treatment and relapse, there are some, particularly high-risk patients, those who present with a white count over 10,000, but from diagnosis, there is virtually no primary resistance. Now, in AML, of course, for example, we can give patients chemotherapy, non-APL AML I'm referring to. We give patients chemotherapy, we repeat the bone marrow on day 14, and there may be still leukemia cells there. And then on day 30, there's still leukemia cells. So it's not, I would say, terribly uncommon to have resistant disease from the outset. In APL, there is no primary resistance. If the patient has APL, as defined by the presence of the PML-RAR-alpha fusion transcript. If they have the fusion transcript, they have APL, there is no primary resistance. So it's a remarkable disease, and we are trying to put major efforts into reducing the risk of early death. I think if we can reduce the risk of early death and now give most patients ATRA-arsenic with no chemotherapy, we will really get very close to curing all patients.
Let's talk a little bit about ALL. Been some interesting, exciting things that have gone on in that field. Again, maybe you can just sort of take a step back and talk about where we've been and where we are right now.
ALL in adults has always been in the shadow, I think, of AML. I always tell the house staff, AML seems to get all the attention. And for a number of reasons. First of all, we think of ALL as a disease of younger patients, particularly children. But it certainly does occur in adults, although there are about 5,000 to 6,000 new cases of ALL per year in the United States. If you use age 20, let's say, as the cutoff to define older and younger, it's about 40% are older than age 20. So the incidence is about 40% of 5,000 to 6,000. So it's a relatively uncommon disease. Again, in adults. And the field had been very stagnant for many years. When you look at large studies over the last 30, 40 years, we seem to be stuck at about 40% cure rate for patients, adults with ALL. While we've been stuck, the pediatricians have made tremendous progress since the mid-1970s, such that in their field now, among their patients, pediatric population of patients, about, again, 85, I think now close to 90% of all children with ALL are now cured of their disease. They've been making tremendous progress. We have not. And I mention that because, and we can talk about some of the reasons why we haven't made such progress, but it's a very important point because one of the major areas of research is to try to adopt pediatric regimens and see if they are as effective in adolescent and young adults, if it can be delivered, as it is in pediatric patients. And in fact, there have been a number of studies published, and it does indeed look like if you take adolescent and young adults, let's say between 15 and 25, some people now extend that to 30 and even 40, and you look at those patients treated on a pediatric protocol and control for other variables, and look at those patients 15 to 25 treated on adult protocols, there are now four, five, six studies in the literature, phase two studies, suggesting that in such a comparative analysis that those patients actually do significantly better if they're treated on a pediatric protocol. So we have now many adult groups. The North American Leukemia Intergroup has, for example, and many other groups around the world have adopted so-called pediatric-inspired protocols and have applied them to adolescent and young adults. And again, we've even extended it now up to patients age 40. And I think that the preliminary evidence suggests that we are finally making some progress in that regard. So I think one of the major areas in which there's been significant progress is the adoption of pediatric protocols for adolescent and young adults. Secondly, there has been also activity in the area of drug discovery, just like there has been in AML. There are a variety of new drugs that look quite promising. Many of these are antibodies, for example, so-called bispecific T-cell engaging antibodies, BITE, B-I-T-E, antibodies that bring an anti-B cell, let's say, antibody with a epitope that recognizes T-cells. And there are a number of other antibodies, rituximab, for example, epertuzumab, other antibodies, inotuzumab, which combines an antibody with a potent toxin. So there's been a number of important agents in the area of T-cell notch inhibitors, has been in the area of T-cell ALL. So drug discovery, I think, is a second important area in which we've made a lot of progress.